It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz in for Kate Archer Kent, and this is your state capitol report. It's called Ethan's Law. It was named for a 7-year-old boy from Manitowoc who died after being abused at his foster home. One of Ethan's foster parents is now on trial for murder, and this is a man with a prior conviction for child abuse. If this bill becomes law, it would close a loophole that lets government agencies place a child in the home of a known abuser. And we're speaking to its authors today. Ethan's Law is just one of many things State Senator Andre Schock has been working on lately. Do you live in Door County or Kewanee? Maybe on the north shore of Lake Winnebago? What issues do you want to see your state lawmakers address? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Andre Jacques is a Republican state senator from De Pere. The district he represents stretches east of Appleton and over to Door County. Senator Jacques, welcome back.
Good morning, Molly. Great to be back on the program.
Good morning. So tell me about Ethan's Law. What a tragic story this was. What inspired you to write this law?
You know, as the father of young kids, including one who just turned 7, the age that Ethan was when he died, it really is horribly tragic. And there were red flags all over the place that should have stopped this placement. And yet there was nothing in the law. In fact, there were things in the law that really prohibited the consideration that we needed to have in there as far as eliminating the gray areas and having clear black and white restrictions on a child in need of protective services not being placed into greater harm's way. And when you have somebody with just the series of violent altercations, as well as the violent child abuse for his own children that he'd previously been convicted of, it's staggering what took place. And I know in the past you've had Doug Schneider on the program. He really did some yeoman's work in illustrating this through the Gannett papers as far as everything that really was bypassed in terms of how many loopholes there were in the system. And this is something that I'm very proud we have on the precipice of being able to be signed into law. We were able to get very strong bipartisan support through the committee and Senate floor process. And hopefully we'll complete the Assembly Committee passage later this week.
Have you spoken with the governor at all about it? Does he intend to sign it?
You know, I don't have any firm, feelings on that. As far as I would imagine, with the very strong bipartisan support, I think the agency has been neutral. But this is something that and having served on the Child Abuse and Neglect Prevention Board, and being joined in that by not only Senator Johnson, who is also on the board, but a number of my Democratic colleagues in the legislature who have actually co-sponsored the legislation, I do feel like this is something that, again, there's really no justification for why you would be placing somebody with a, child abuse of a physical nature, having them responsible for the care of somebody who is just leaving an at-risk situation or been abused themselves already. This is just something that makes sense and something that has, frankly, been welcomed by a lot of the human services workers that I've talked to in terms of not feeling pressured to make a placement in a situation that they don't feel is safe.
Yeah. And what do you think we need to do to encourage more caring adults to become foster parents?
Well, I think certainly taking steps like this, I've had strong support from the Lakeshore foster families and friends, of course, in that area where Ethan had passed. But so many foster parents that I talk to, it is something where, they just are so mad. And the fact that there are placements where children are being put at risk, hopefully we can encourage more people to take that step. I know one of the other bipartisan issues that I'm working on right now deals with permanency plans and restoring what we had in place before, which is sharing the child's story with them. And right now we trust them with the care of the child, but they really need to know everything that's going on to be an effective foster parent. And, you know, I think there are certainly other things that we can do in the system to show that that they are valued. I think that is certainly one of the issues that I have heard is that right now, it is word of mouth from those that are already fostering children, and they want to know that that they are going to be respected, that they are going to have, you know, both the state and county partner with them, as opposed to put them in difficult positions without resources.
Yeah. And I saw you also had a bill that would grant legal immunity to anyone who helps out in good faith with cases of child abuse. Currently, that legal immunity, as I understand it, only extends to people who are mandatory reporters, people like pediatricians and teachers. Why do more people need this immunity?
You know, that's actually part of some federal funding requirements as well. It's called CAPTA. It's one of a couple pieces of what's going through the system right now where you do have, again, those that are involved in providing medical examinations that need to have some immunity in making reports. It is something that I don't think has been abused. But, you know, I care pretty deeply about protecting our children. They're our state's most valuable resource. And it is something that, you know, particularly has been exacerbated as a result of COVID-19 and having children out of school. You haven't had less child abuse that's taken place, but you haven't had as many interventions in terms of places where children are going. And it is something that, you know, just as we've seen with domestic violence, human trafficking, you know, we've seen spikes in terms of the actual crime that's taking place, but we, you know, aren't necessarily getting to effective reporting or solving some of those situations. And those are some of the other things that I'm trying to address again as well. I know I've been on the program before talking about human trafficking and addressing the demand side as well as victim services. I have a domestic violence lease bill that's passed unanimously out of my committee as well this session. So, you know,
there's
a lot of different pieces to the puzzle.
Yeah, and one of it, I imagine, is funding. I saw there was a provision in the governor's budget for $15 million in block grants to help counties with their child welfare caseloads. Do you support that?
I don't know if I saw the specific increase that you're talking to there. I mean, there is going to be an issue with the governor increasing spending. I think it was 8.8%, close to 10%, and dependent on some tax and fee increases that aren't likely to be there at the end. But certainly one of the things that I was a very strong proponent of last session, I believe, was $30 million. Through the state budget that we were able to do to bolster child in need of protective services programs at the county level, things that were are going to be affected by something like Ethan's Law in terms of having social workers and addressing backlogs that previously existed. So
yeah.
Certainly there are separate block grant funds as well. The state was a little late to the game in terms of applying for those funds, but now that we've received them, they have put together plans as far as, you know, child care and other resources to help children and families. And so that's certainly something that I'm very interested in. And I think, yes, there's going to be some significant resources put towards children and families in this budget, certainly, and very supportive of that.
Yeah. Senator Jacques, I saw that you authored a bill that would ban health insurers from denying coverage based on pre-existing conditions. Don't we already have that under the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah. So it currently is part of the Affordable Care Act. However, not at the state level. And of course, there have been various court cases that have been out there. I think this is basically saying to all residents of the state that regardless of what happens at the federal level, that in Wisconsin, that component of pre-existing condition protection is going to remain there and it's going to be strong. And in fact, I'm pleased that we went from having all Republicans and about half of Democrats in support of the bill last session to a unanimous 92-0 vote in the Assembly already this session. But it deals with, guaranteed issue, no exclusions, no lifetime caps, and the community rating provision. So it is going to be as strong as anything that's out there in terms of pre-existing conditions. And it's just something that I think, we had moved to that point largely in the healthcare debate previously. But it's something that is going to be, I think, one of the foundations of whatever, health plan the state level looks at going into the future.
Sure. We're speaking with State Senator Andre Jacques of De Pere, and this is the State Capitol Report. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. This is your State Capitol Report. We have State Senator Andre Jacques of De Pere with us this morning. He represents Door and Kewaunee counties, parts of Brown, Manitowoc, Calumet, and Outagamie counties. Are you a constituent? What problems should state lawmakers be tackling? Let us know. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Senator, I want to talk about some of your COVID-related bills. You authored one that would ban the government from requiring the COVID vaccine. Doesn't current law allow people to opt out already?
There currently is an exemption. However, it does not apply to the COVID vaccine in terms of an emergency health declaration. It also is something where we have had difficulty in enforcing our existing exemptions. And I've heard that from healthcare employees. I've heard that from the general public, whether that's talking about a religious exemption or a health exemption. In actually many cases, in fact, there have been court cases where after the fact you have had Wisconsin employers that have, it's been found that they have not abided by the exclusions. But it is something that, according to our legislative attorneys, there is the ability for vaccines to be mandated under a public health emergency, and same thing with church closures. And there are a lot of concerns with that. Obviously, they haven't litigated the First Amendment concerns as far as what might take place in a court case there. But they're actually among several COVID-related bills that I've put forward.
Yeah.
Going back to last session, dealing with telehealth, dealing with additional flexibility for local governments or remote court hearings. And pleased to see that some of them have already passed both chambers of the legislature.
Do you worry at all that our state won't reach herd immunity?
It seems like the vaccine rollout has been going fairly well after some initial fits and starts. I think by and large, what we found is when you have a mandate, when you have coercion, you're not necessarily going to persuade people or achieve a better rate of vaccination than in this case. There have been studies that show neighboring countries of similar demographics where you did not achieve any higher rate of vaccination when you had a mandate in place. And it is something where, it's very difficult to compel that. Anyways, I think ultimately it has to be through better communication. It has to be through a full explanation of the risks or research. But by and large, I think most people have indicated that they are going to be receiving the vaccine. And so it is certainly well underway.
Are you planning to get vaccinated?
Well, I'm not going to get into anything personal that way, but I will say I'm certainly not anti-vaccine. And the COVID vaccine is a little different from other vaccines in terms of the process that it went through. But I certainly expect that members of my family will be vaccinated at the point that they are eligible to do so. It's certainly something that my children have been vaccinated as well. But there can be certainly concerns just in terms of which variant of a vaccine somebody might choose to receive as well. And then, you know, that availability might not be something that is available on the front end of the vaccination process as well.
So, right. It feels like we're in this race against the variants to immunize everyone before there's possible mutations.
Well, and the fact is that, you know, those mutations are already occurring, where there's questions as to, you know, the existing vaccines, how well do they protect against different variants? And there's certainly a lot of questions out there in terms of various subpopulations and just exactly, I mean, there's still questions out there, but I think certainly a lot of people have been pleased that they've been able to, you know, receive it for those in the highest risk categories.
Sure, sure. And I saw that you had a bill that would also prohibit employers from requiring vaccination for their employees. Would that be the case even for public workers, school teachers, kind of highly public positions?
That would be, when you look at the vaccine, it's meant to protect yourself personally, as opposed to, you know, it isn't something where it necessarily even keeps you from getting the virus. It's supposed to mitigate the possibility of it becoming a serious case, but receiving the vaccine isn't necessarily going to prevent you from transmitting it to others. And to answer your question, yes, it would apply to public employers as well. In fact, that was one of the situations that already has been brought up, where you've had a number of employees laid off at Rockhaven, a nursing home facility run by the county in Janesville, where you had a number of employees that were reporting adverse reactions to the virus. I'm sorry, to the vaccine, which is certainly something that, what they call them, bad batches or the like, but have been reported elsewhere. But, you know, again, you have had situations where, absent this sort of legislation, those that have basically had life-threatening, almost life-ending complications previously, things like Guillain-Barré syndrome, would not be able to, you know, use that as a basis potentially to not have to, you know, have a vaccine in order to continue their employment, provide for their family.
Yeah. Well, I want to switch gears before we run out of time with you. You have so many bills. You've got so much going on. And I want to talk about roads because, you know, our roads, they need some help. And I saw you had a bill that would direct some of the sales taxes from, you know, buying or leasing a car to go to fund transportation projects like road repairs that we need. Why do we need to change the way we fund roads?
Oh, absolutely. So I think when you have transportation-related sales tax, it only makes sense when you have those vehicle-related purchases for some of that money to go towards repairing our roads and diversifying the funding for our transportation fund. It's something that I think there's very broad bipartisan support for. It's certainly something that I think we have seen, you know, it needs to be a priority for our economy. For it is something that has been a priority, but the problem is, by the time through the budget process people actually come to an agreement, it's at the end of the process where you either have to not spend it or bond for it. And I think, you know, on a bipartisan basis, there's concerns about putting things on the credit card. At one point, we had gotten north of 20% of the transportation fund was going to debt service. So I think the extent to which we can take the growth that we have seen in sales tax and put some of that towards the transportation fund, where we now protect it from various fund raids, it is something where we're going to be able to, you know, say transportation is a priority. We are going to provide that funding for it and do it in a way that there's less pressure to borrow or to look at other areas of the budget. It really is something that I think helps our long-term planning, and certainly something I've had, you know, positive conversations with Secretary-designee Thompson about. And there are other process reforms, things that we can do to stretch existing dollars. But
do you, Senator, do you risk kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul, so to speak, and kind of taking money out of the same pot that goes to fund schools?
No, I really don't think that you do in the sense that the amount that would be going on a phased-in basis over to the transportation fund is less than the traditional growth that we have seen in sales tax revenue over the last several budgets. And it is something that, you know, if we say transportation is a priority, I mean, certainly there's going to be plenty of money available for additional spending in other areas. And we have seen spending growth over the last several budgets. But, I think, you know, when you have various things like the gas tax that are based on a diminishing stream of revenue because of fuel efficiency, and also something that is concerning because it's a regressive tax. I think when you're able to diversify to something like sales tax, which is consumption based and something that, you know, again, I think has more of that that broad based support. I think, you know, it just makes sense to say that we are going to, you know, just a portion of, you know, that vehicle related sales tax that we already have coming into the state coffers is going to go towards transportation, as opposed to having to rehash this, you know, this argument at the start of every budget process of should we put additional money into transportation or should we look at, you know, a very small number of potential revenue streams to add that funding.
Right, because gas taxes are short of where the budget thought they would be, but sales taxes are up, so that's where the money is, so to speak. Senator Jacques, we are up against the clock, but I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Absolutely. No, it's great to be back on the program. And, you know, I think I've had 14 bills that have passed the Senate already, another four that have passed the Assembly. So hopefully we can get as many of them to pass both chambers and get a whole bunch more. And appreciate the time.
Yeah, thank you so much. Andre Jacques is a Republican state senator from De Pere. Just ahead, it can be hard enough to get a vaccine appointment as it is. Now imagine doing it blind. We talk about that and more after the news. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show. You're listening to The Ideas Network.